Good morning. So today things are really going to start getting concrete where, you know, we've talked about a lot of architecture ideas, but today we're really going to talk about programming the GPU using a technology called CUDA. But before we do so, I just want to go over a few announcements. First is, I think I mentioned the first day of class that I interned with IBM Research at their Ulmanin Research Lab in San Jose. Well, we have an adjunct faculty here who's going to give a talk later in the semester on using the GPU to accelerate search. He's really interested in doing like parallel database algorithms. He's going to come in a few weeks to give a talk, but he's also interested if there's any PhD students here that are looking for internships this summer at the IBM Ulmanin Research Lab in San Jose. It's a really great place to be. I mean, this is a picture of the buildings here. Almost everyone has windows, and they're like right in like the rolling hills of San Jose with fantastic views. They do a lot of, when I was there, I did distributed storage systems. They more or less invented the relational database there and did a lot of the initial hard drive work. But I think they do a lot more than just storage there. So please email me and I'll put you in touch with them if you'd be interested in talking about doing that this summer. But I can't recommend the place enough. Also, I don't know if I explicitly mentioned this in class, but a lot of these CUDA lectures will follow the book, Programming Massively Parallel Processors, pretty closely. And I list the reading up on the website, so you can see, like, for today, we're going to follow Chapter 3 pretty closely. It's up to you if you want to read before or after. It's really hard for me to say which one is better. I mean, if you follow the lectures pretty well without reading it beforehand, then I'd probably recommend reading it afterwards. But if not, then you know you could try to read it beforehand. And these are the chapters for the print version of the book. If you're using the older PDFs, the draft PDFs that are on the UIUC website, they're not going to match up exactly. So it'll be up to you to figure out how to match them up. And then finally, if you don't have a GitHub account, you need to email me today. And I'll set you up tonight. And if you haven't cloned your Git repository for the first homework, you should also do that today. Like, if you email me, you know, Monday, like 5 p.m., like, I might not get to it until 9 p.m. You'll have 3 hours to do your homework. So make sure that you do that ASAP. Has anyone ran into problems doing it? It seems like a lot of people have been cloning okay. Cool. Good. Okay, so a lot of these CUDA slides, a lot of the images will come from the UIUC course, which they were among the first, if not the first, to offer a course in GPU computing. And the professor who was teaching that course co-authored our book, too. So today, I want to just briefly review some ideas about parallelism and the GPU architecture stuff from Monday. But we're really going to focus on this technology called CUDA, this language called CUDA, and how we can use CUDA to program the GPUs. Okay, so there's really like three big ideas in parallelism that we implicitly talked about, but I didn't really lay them out over the past couple lectures. I mean, the first is this idea of pipeline parallelism, where we can have a task and we can break it up into subtasks. And then we can have subtasks from different tasks executed at the same time, right? And really, like, when they're teaching this in computer architecture, they really use the laundry example, where if you're doing several loads of laundry, you have two, that's each load of laundry is a task, right? And then you break it into two subtasks, washing and drying. So you start one load, you put it in the washer, and then when that comes out, you put it in the dryer, but then you don't wait for it to come out of the dryer before you put your second load in, right? You pipeline it. So that's the idea of pipeline parallelism, right? And the most common example in computer architecture is a pipelined instructions, where a processor has multiple instructions in flight at the same time, where different stages of that instruction are being executed. In graphics, this idea, the whole rasterization pipeline, where we start with triangles on one end and then eventually create colored pixels on the other end, that is this big, giant pipeline, too, where you can imagine as triangles enter that pipeline, you don't need to fully create pixels from them before you start putting more triangles into that pipeline. So in fact, older graphics pipelines, they were so deep. They were like 1,000, like when they were all in fixed function, they were like 1,000 stages deep. Or 12, I have to look at the exact reference, but I want to say it's like 1,000 or even 1,200. I'm very old NVIDIA cards. Okay, so another one that when we're programming CPU, something that we're probably really familiar with is task-level parallelism, where we have multiple things, multiple tasks that we can do at the same time, right? And something that is probably very familiar to all of us, certainly I rely on it a lot, is a spell checker, right? If I'm in Microsoft Word or now if I'm in Gmail and spell checking in the background, most commonly you would do that on a separate thread, right? So you have one thread running the UI and then another thread doing the spell checking. And they're independent for the most part. Of course, as your text changed, the spell checker needs to know about that. And threading is just one way to accomplish task-based parallelism. But you might also look at, say, a game engine, and there's actually a lot of work right now in multi-threading game engines. A very coarse breakdown is shown here on the right. This is from like a 2006 Game Developer Magazine article, where you can see there's artificial intelligence, character animation, and collision detection that are pretty big, coarse-grained subcomponents that can kind of be ran in parallel. Although I will say, in reality, and it's kind of shown here in the red dash, there's certainly some dependencies here where you can imagine that the animation, the collision detection might actually depend on the animation system. If you're doing very fine-grained collision detection, you need to run your animation first. So a big problem here with task-level parallelism is you got to really find out what is independent and what isn't. Nowadays, more recently in game engines, you'll see job systems. Like, are you guys familiar with id Tech 5? Or is anyone playing Rage from id? Are you guys playing that? I've been meaning to play it, but I still haven't. It's been out for a while. But they rely that and Frostbite 2, what's that, Battlefield? Is that the game? Battlefield 3 maybe is just that. Those engines rely on something called a job system, where they kind of go a little more coarse-grained than what you see. This is very coarse-grained. We have three high-level subsystems, whereas they go a lot more fine-grained, where they have very fine-grained jobs. This character needs to load this mesh, or this mesh needs to be processed before I can load this. And they build a whole dependency graph, and then they give it to an engine that figures out all the dependencies and how to do the parallelism in terms of how many threads does it need and all that sort of stuff. It's very cool, and I may find an excuse to fit it into this class, even though it's not exactly GPU programming. And then finally, something that's probably closest to home for me, at least, since I work a lot with virtual globes, is when we look at these 3D virtual globes, and I have an example up from Nokia, and it just so happens to be running in WebGL, because we all know how much I love WebGL. Right, so this is something we're going to look at later in the semester, but again, this is just a web page that I brought up that has real deal hardware accelerated 3D graphics in it. And this, you guys have ran like Google Earth or maybe NASA Worldwin. Here, this is, 3D globe, and it's got lots of data. And even this one even has city data, which is pretty impressive. And then you saw, as I zoomed in, it started loading new data, right? So the rendering is something that we can do on one thread, but then all the I.O., right, there's no way it was going over the network in the same thread that it was doing the rendering, right? It would have been so choppy. So when you look at task-based parallelism here, you have rendering, and then you have I.O. separately. Now, since this is done in JavaScript and WebGL, I'm sure that the parallelism is not done via threading, but it's probably done via asynchronous request, where when this asks for a piece of geometry for the buildings or a texture for the globe, that request is non-blocking, and then we'll get a call back when it finishes. But in globes here, it goes way beyond, just I.O. and rendering at the same time, but we might need to pre-process things. As we zoom in here, we might need to compute normals for geometry, or we might need to reproject it, and that's potentially CPU intensive, and we might do that in a separate thread as well. So there's definitely quite a bit of task level parallelism here. But the big thing I want you guys to think about is a lot of this task level stuff is pretty coarse grained. Okay? When I say coarse grained, there's maybe a few tasks that we do in parallelism, in task-based parallelism. Now, as opposed to the final type of parallelism I want to mention, which is data parallel. And this, we talked about SIMD instructions, but this is the idea that we have a whole lot of data and we can run the same program on it. And one example that I'm sure is familiar to many of you, definitely DMD students and CGDT students, is a cloth simulation. And this cloth here, you know, this is modeled with a mass spring damper system where these masses are connected. Think of like a 2D grid with a bunch of masses in it. And they're connected to other masses via springs and dampers. And when you pull one mass, it starts to propagate and pull the other ones. Well, the forces you can compute on any mass can be done independent of any other mass at every time step. And then, you know, over time, over several times, you have a cloth simulation. And here this cloth is being draped over a tortoise. And this was actually done by one of our students. This simulation here was done GPU accelerated. I think it was last spring Han did it. So it's pretty cool. You see he has nice lighting on there, so it looks really good. Same idea for particle systems, right? You guys have seen maybe explosions, you know, with particle systems in games, where all these different particles have forces, like, you know, gravity or thrust or wind. And the force, you know, eventually is integrated to get acceleration, velocity, and then a position at every time step. And each particle can be processed independently. So you could sit on the CPU in a for loop, right? Or we're going to try to utilize the GPU to really take advantage of this data level parallelism. And then the final example I have here is matrix multiply, which I could joke and say that like a lot of this course is about how do you optimize matrix multiply, because we're going to use matrix multiply as a running example of a data parallel operation and how can we really optimize that optimization on the GPU. Because by the end of today, you guys will all be able to write a parallel matrix multiply on the GPU. But we'll need maybe like 6 more lectures for you guys to do it really fast, or to make your code run really fast. So I just want to do some refresher on what is matrix multiply and some of the details behind it. I know for the graphic students, you know, you guys have multiplied a bazillion matrices probably in the past week. But I just want to make sure that we're on a level playing field here. So everyone is comfortable with the idea of having of vectors, right? Does anyone? Does this scare anyone at all? Now, if you see a vector, right, it's a bunch of scalars in a column. And then you can multiply two vectors, right? And there's different operations that you can do when you do this. Multiply can mean different things. But there's the dot product where you can dot two vectors. And do you guys know what the dot product is? If the vectors are normalized, yes, it's the angle between the two vectors. The cosine of the angle between the two vectors. So a lot of times in graphics, we want to see if, we'll use this for lighting all the time, where we care about the cosine. If you have, here's a pixel that we're going to light, and then we have a light source, the dot product between these two vectors can tell us the intensity of the light, where if the light's right over top, the cosine is 1, and then the cosine will drop off as you come looking at it from the horizon, and it'll even be negative down here. So the dot product, right, it's just the sum of the products here. So you get a scalar, right, you multiply two, you dot two vectors, you get a scalar. So here this is just XA, XB, plus YA, YB, plus ZA, ZB, right? And everyone is very comfortable with this, right? It's just some simple manipulation. So a matrix, right, is 2D grid of numbers, and I'll just draw out a 2x2 one. So here's two matrices that I'm saying that we're going to multiply together. And the vectors I'm showing here are 3D vector, because that's what I use most often, right? But a vector, it can be of any size. It can be huge. And then same with these matrices. And we're just really, just for our simple examples, we're just going to deal with square matrices. But of course, they certainly don't have to be. So when we go to multiply two matrices, all it is a bunch of dot products, okay? So these two 2x2 matrices will wind up with 4 elements in here. Each one of these is a dot product. So we take, to get the upper left here, let's call this M and N and P. We're going to take this column and this row. We're going to dot product to get here. And then we're going to move over one column, same row, dot product. Then we're going to come down to this row, and then again, sweep across the columns and dot product here. So right, so it's four dot products. Everyone's good. We have to be comfortable with this, right? Okay, so where's the parallelism?
Each separate dot product is a parallelism.
So does everyone agree that each dot product can be computed in parallel? Okay, good, very good. One thing. When we're storing a matrix in an array, right? So say, how would you guys store this? Say I have four variables here, A00, A10, et cetera, et cetera. In what order would you store them in this matrix? I'll give you two options. So I stored each row across, right? Or you could imagine that I could go down each column, A00, A01, A10, A11. How would you guys store it? It's sort of a trick question in that, like, I guess I don't really care how you store it as long as you're aware of how it's being stored. So in OpenGL, things are what they call column major, where we take each column and we store that linearly in an array, right? Now, for a lot of the examples that we're doing here with CUDA, we're storing everything row major. So we took the top row, then we took the bottom row and kind of put it right next to four across. We call that row major, right? So just be aware, row major versus column major. The examples we're doing are row major. You're likely to get bugs with this in your graphics code if you haven't already. You know, if you do, just transpose the matrix. Okay. So just a quick refresher for what we've been talking about for GPUs, right? GPUs, they're capable of massive parallelism, and they're multi-threaded or threads. They're super lightweight. They're super cheap to create. They're super cheap to swap, and they're super cheap to retire as well. And then GPUs are many core, as opposed to a CPU, which is multi-core, whereas GPU is many core. Now remember, not all cores are created equal, right? And a CPU, cores are pretty beefy, and you know, and they really include all the control logic and everything. Whereas a lot of the GPU terminology, a core is really just an ALU. And then really, we're looking to utilize GPUs because we know that they have a lot of gigaflops or teraflops at this point. And the memory bandwidth, like I said, is high, but it's higher than what we'll get in a system memory bandwidth, but it's not like insane. In fact, we're always going to be bottlenecked by it. So again, we're looking for compute-intense, highly parallel computations, and that's talking about a lot of compute relative to memory access. I mean, if you have a problem that is really compute-intensive and doesn't read a lot of memory, like the most naive GPU implementation is going to be awesome. And this just so happens to be the case that graphics falls into this category. And then again, this is, you know, hopefully beaten to death at this point, but we really take transistors and we use them for computational units as opposed to fancy data caching and flow control with out of order and things like that. And then here, this is something you'll see NVIDIA show you a lot, where you say, hey, look, on the left here's a CPU with a big cache and big control unit. And then, hey, if we use the same size in a GPU, but we just throw a bunch of ALUs at it. And that's, you know, a simplistic version, but it's okay for our current understanding. All right, so like I've been saying all along, all I really care about is can we program this thing and can we make our code run efficiently? So GPUs themselves have been around for a while. I want to say like 96 or so, maybe like the Voodoo FX came out or so. And they were really made to accelerate graphics, right? We were doing 3D rendering, we were doing it in software. And id was particularly good at doing it in software, if you guys have played like Wolfenstein or the original Doom. And later in the semester, we will go over the history of the graphics pipeline. We'll show exactly how they started evolving from software to hardware. But let's pick up where we have, where we already have a GPU, but it's, you know, 10 years ago. GPU was just made for doing graphics, for accelerating rendering. But researchers started looking at it, and they said, hey, you know what? This is really a data parallel coprocessor, where the CPU is our main processor, but the GPU is capable of data parallel operations. The thing is, you can only program it through a rendering API that, you know, you draw triangles and you read from textures and you blend things. So they started figuring out ways to hack up the OpenGL API, you know, hack up graphics algorithms to run general purpose computations. So instead of each pixel being, or each texel in a texture being a color, they go, oh, well, that's actually a position for a particle. Or instead of each vertex in a mesh being the position of an object that you're going to render, no, each vertex is a separate position for a mass in a Clough simulation. So they come up with ways to fit general problems into the graphics world, and they really do some interesting stuff to hack up the pipeline. And when I took this class 5 years ago, that's how we did general purpose computation on the GPU, was we hacked up the OpenGL pipeline. Now, we're not going to do that at all. There's certainly no assignments where you're going to hack up the pipeline to do that. And we will only briefly talk about it. Like last year, I think I had like maybe a half a lecture on it. But at this point, it's becoming so so uncommon that it's really not. It's just almost a thing of the past, I'd say, at this point. So then, you know, NVIDIA started seeing that, hey, people are using the GPU for general computations. So they came out with CUDA, Compute Uniform Device Architecture, right? Which this now is, it's not a graphics language. It's a general language for running on the GPU. And like I said, when I took this class, we actually used CUDA under simulation. Like, I didn't even have the hardware that could run CUDA, but we had a simulation where we ran it on the CPU. And now kind of the term has switched from GPGPU, general purpose GPU, to GPU computing. Then a little more recently, the Kronos group came out with OpenCL. So Kronos is kind of like a governing body for a number of industry standards, including OpenGL and WebGL. And they came out with the OpenCL specification, where OpenCL is an open compute language. And then the difference between CUDA and OpenCL is CUDA runs on NVIDIA hardware, whereas OpenCL will run on ATI hardware, it will run on Intel, well, probably Intel, we'll see, where OpenCL will run on a lot of different hardware. But it's arguably a little bit harder to use. It's a little more fine-grained in terms of the number of API calls you need to make to do things. So we could almost argue, though, that if OpenCL lets us run on a lot more different kinds of hardware, well, why don't we just forget about CUDA, right? Why don't we just use OpenCL? Do you guys have an answer to that? That is the answer because I only know CUDA. No, so the answer is certainly I know more about CUDA than I do OpenCL. But when you're really doing GPU computing, you're going to wind up tweaking it quite a bit for a particular GPU that you're targeting because they all have different warp sizes, different amounts of shared memory, different amount of processors. So you write once, run anywhere is actually pretty hard on the GPU. So if you're using CUDA, you know, you are tied to NVIDIA, but if you're using OpenCL, you're probably going to be tied to a couple cards, or you're going to have a lot of different paths for different types of cards that you're running on. Geez, I run into this problem in graphics all the time, where especially now that we're doing WebGL, and you know, we might run on a desktop or we might run on a mobile, right? So yeah, I can get the same code to run on both of them, but I really want to do different optimizations on different platforms too. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about CUDA, right? There's a couple big ideas here. One is going to be a hierarchy of thread groups, and you know, when you think hierarchy, don't get scared. Oh my God, it's going to be like this deep, you know, 20-level hierarchy of threads. It's really just two levels of threads. And it's going to be shared memories, like we talked about on Monday, that some threads are going to be able to use to coordinate with other threads. And then we're also going to have synchronization, where we can have a group of threads that all say, hey, once we get to this instruction, we're going to want to stop. And they'll use that to coordinate, usually to bring things into memory and the such. Okay, so some of the terminology here might be a little different to what we're used to, but